Thank you. Be seated.
Justice Gonzalez is not feeling well, but he intends to participate in the deliberation and decision of Travelers Indemnity Company versus Honorable Alan Mayfield. The court is ready to hear argument from Relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young will present argument for Relator. Relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. There are three conceivable sources of authority for the respondent's order in this case that Travelers pay the real party's attorney's fees on a monthly basis: constitutional authority, statutory authority, and the inherent power of the courts. In response to the mandamus petition, declines to join issue on the constitutional basis, if any, for the respondent's order. And so I don't propose to address that this morning except to answer any questions that the court may have. And I'll address the other conceivable bases in order. First, with respect to any statutory basis, Government Code Section 24016 authorizes appointment of counsel where a party is, quote, too poor to employ counsel, close quote. And it was under that statute that Mr. Ragland was appointed. The pre-1879 version of that statute expressly declared that the services of appointed counsel were to be pro bono. And in 1879, in a recodification, that provision was taken out of the statute. Now, the plaintiff infers from that silence a discretion on the part of the trial court to determine the sources of compensation for appointed counsel. There are two problems with that approach. First, it is contrary to the rule long established by this court that attorney's fees may be shifted only pursuant to express statutory or rule-based authorization and may not be shifted by implication. And secondly, it is contrary to the express provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act. This court has reaffirmed in case after case that Texas follows the American rule, that attorney's fees are recoverable only when provided by statute or contract. And furthermore, that shifting requires an express legislative direction and may not occur by implication. That was the holding of this court in First City Bank versus Buicks, it's the holding of this court in the New Amsterdam casualty case, and in the Neeble versus Capital National Bank case. Thus, a statute like 24016, which is silent on the subject of attorney's fees, cannot be read by implication to authorize shifting of those attorney's fees to the opposing litigant.
Mr. Young?
Yes, sir.
If I understand the other part of the statute, if the claimant recovers the benefits they're asking for, they get the attorney's fee at the end. Is that?
That is correct, Your Honor.
The real part is there's no constitutional, statutory, or inherent power to require the defendant Travelers to pay the fees incrementally up front.
Well, that is correct, Your Honor. Moreover, even at the end of the case, under the Workers' Compensation Act, those fees are not added to the claimant's recovery. They are drawn from the claimant's recovery. The statute directs the carrier to issue two checks each week, one to the claimant for her portion of the benefits, and one to the attorney for whatever benefits the commission or court has approved, whatever attorney.
So your position on the statute then is there's no authority whatsoever to require the other side to pay the attorney's fees over and above the recovery?
That's right, in the workers' compensation case. There are other sources of potential compensation for appointed counsel under Section 24016. For example, where the cause of action involves statutory fee shifting, there's no reason that appointed counsel couldn't, in an appropriate case, take advantage of that, again, at the end of the case. Where the case is amenable to a contingency fee arrangement, that perhaps might require approval of the trial court, but that certainly would be a permissible source of compensation. The trial court has the option of appointing an attorney employed by a legal services agency, or has the option of asking counsel to take on the case pro bono. And finally, if all of those expedients fail, and it is necessary for the court's proper functioning that a party have counsel, the court may or may not have inherent authority to require public funding of counsel fees. But in any event, there is no authority for private funding based on statute. So in general, and under the Workers' Compensation Act in particular, the respondent's order cannot be sustained on any statutory basis. With respect to the inherent power doctrine, that is a doctrine of allocation of governmental power. And it requires the allocation to the judiciary of sufficient governmental power to enable the judiciary to carry out its core function of administering justice. It is not a doctrine which gives the court inherent power over private individuals and over the funds of those private individuals. And there's a reason behind that. The inherent power doctrine is born of necessity. To use the words of the late Justice Spears, it flows from the law of self-preservation. And so it may, from time to time, in the interest of self-preservation and enabling the courts to carry out their core functions, be necessary to compel public funding, for example, of court reporter salaries or constable salaries or what have you. But with public funding as an available alternative, compelled private funding is never necessary. And being never necessary, it is never part of the inherent power of the courts. Instead, the proper role of the courts is to do as the court did in the school finance case, to declare the need, to require the legislative branch to supply the necessary funding, but to leave it to the legislative branch, which does have the power to compel private citizens to fund public needs through taxes and fees and so forth, to determine the appropriate funding mechanism. And so in conclusion, the respondent, we believe, enjoyed neither statutory nor inherent power-based authority to require travelers to pay Ms. Reed's attorney's fees on a monthly basis. And for that reason, we believe that a conditional writ of mandamus should issue.
Any questions?
Well, yes, I have a quick question. Would you explain to me why it is that you couldn't have just gone ahead and paid the money and had this matter resolved on appeal as opposed to having it handled by mandate? In other words, why is this matter
We could have done that, and that would have provided us with partial relief in that if we prevailed, we would get our money back. That would not have relieved us of the burden of funding our opponent's litigation, of providing our opponent with a war chest with which to fight us.
So that is the real harm.
That is the harm that is irremediable by appeal. It is part of the harm. The other part of the harm is having to pay the money and not getting it back, which is remediable by appeal. But they're both aspects of it.
Travelers non-suited immediately, right?
Travelers non-suited immediately after the respondent's order that it was going to have to pay Ms. Reed's attorney's fees. And indeed before Mr. Ragland made any appearance on behalf of Ms. Reed.
If you're going to have to ultimately pay Ms. Reed's attorney's fees, why is it irreparable harm to have to pay them now rather than later?
Again, because of the timing issue. Because we are required not only to pay her a sum of money, but we're required to give her a sum of money which she can then use to fight us on an ongoing, continuous basis for the entirety of the litigation.
Is there anything in the court's order that said these payments would be offset against whatever amount?
The order is totally silent on that.
Can you fit this into a any particular language of one of our previous cases on irreparable harm?
Your Honor, I think it falls under the prong of Walker versus Packer that deals with injury that cannot be remedied following an appeal. It's a little different from disclosure of privileged information that once it's out can never be brought back in. But the idea that we have to bankroll, to float, to finance Ms. Reed during the pendency of the litigation. Once the litigation takes place, we have bankrolled her whether she has to pay back that interest-free loan or not. And that's the harm that can't be remedied by people.
And I'm thinking of divorce litigation where the court has the authority, statutory authority, to award interim attorney's fees. How is that any different from the harm that you're alleging here?
I don't think it is, except for the substantive fact that the court has much broader discretion and power to do that. I think if you got to a case where there was a clear abuse of the trial court's discretion, then that would satisfy the inadequate remedy by law
aspect of it. Certainly, it's a little different in that we're ordered to pay each and every month as an attorney's fees award is approved, where what Your Honor is talking about might be a one-time thing or occur a couple of times during the proceedings. But I think the key difference there is there would much more seldom be any clear abuse of discretion that would meet the basic substantive test for mandamus.
Another question then. If you pay the sums and then at the final judgment the claimant recovers the benefits, did you say that they're paid on some installment basis?
Under the respondent's order, we pay month by month.
Now,
if there were no order and the claimant recovered attorney's fees at the end of the case, they would be taken out of each payment to the claimant.
Her recovery.
That's correct.
And as I understood your comment, they would be paid in two checks, one to her for her part and right. one check to the attorney for his
as each payment accrues. And in rare exceptions, the current act has abolished lump sum payments.
Since you would have paid the attorney's fees in advance under the trial court's order, is it possible that you could also be a third recipient of a check to repay the attorney's fees that you got so that you are repaid and that your statement there's no way to recovery has any support?
That is correct, assuming that the claimant ultimately prevails.
Now, they say because you've non-suited your claim that there's no way she's not going to prevail.
Well, we're continuing to pay her weekly benefits, so she is going to prevail to that extent. But the question then becomes, first of all, the respondent has made no order authorizing that kind of an offset. So far as the respondent...
Well, but we don't know whether he would or not. So
that's right.
So we can't speculate on that.
That's
and I
right.
guess the real issue is, assume that there is abuse of discretion because there's no way to do it under either one of the three ways that you talk about, we still have the problem of adequate remedy on appeal. Or by that... other thing that you can get your percentage or your fees back out of her recovery.
That gives us our money back, just as we could get our money back on Mr. Ragland writing a check to us, but it doesn't relieve us from the temporal element of having to finance her litigation against us.
That's the only basis then for your argument that the harm is irreparable and can't be fixed otherwise.
Well, we also have questions about the ultimate recoverability of the fee, not necessarily from Mr. Ragland, but from the claimant herself, but we recognize...
Well, but I understand that, but I think there's a lot of cases that say that's not a consideration.
That's Lone Star versus Street.
That's right, yeah.
Do you concede that Ms. Reed will ultimately be able to recover some attorney's fees, given the posture of the case? That is, you're continuing to pay her... weekly benefits, you've non-suited your claim. Is she ultimately going to be able to recover some attorney's fees?
Well, she is recovering weekly checks, which at the present time are not offset for any attorney's fees. So she's recovering her full weekly entitlement to compensation. How long that will continue is an open question because we've non-suited our appeal. Eventually, the Workers' Compensation Commission will determine that she's reached maximum medical improvement. And if it finds her injury to have been compensable, then her disability benefits will start.
And regardless of what happens, she will never recover any attorney's fees from your side. You will never have to pay her.
That's correct. Any attorney's fees that she pays are by the Comp Act supposed to come out of her recovery.
And if you have to pay for her attorney along the way, and that has to be repaid to you down the road, that in essence would mean that she would wind up with nothing.
Well, she is guaranteed 75% of her entitlement. The attorney's fees can come out only of the 25%. But yes, it would be our position that we are subrogated to Mr. Ragland to the extent that we've paid his bill.
Now that you've non-suited, does the order require you to continue to pay the attorney's fees?
It does, and the first order requiring payment of attorney's fees, was issued after the non-suit. Respondent has not issued any more orders requiring us to pay attorney's fees, perhaps in light of this mandamus. But the first order requiring payment was after the non-suit, and it was for services rendered at least in part after the non-suit.
And have you paid any attorney's fees?
We have not. We have agreed with Mr. Ragland to suspend the actual payment pending resolution of this mandamus.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Tom Ragland will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the Court, I think it's important to put the case back in perspective in that at the time Mrs. Reed was sued by Travelers, she had in her possession a final order of the Workers' Compensation Commission awarding her benefits, which the record shows was about $17,000. And Travelers Indemnity sued her to vacate that award, asked that it be vacated, and all costs for it be agreed. Now, it's different, I believe, pleads the Court, than a situation where she received an award which she perceived to be inadequate or no award and appealed that herself, trying to get the district court to award benefits. It's entirely different. She got the award, she was satisfied with the award, and Travers was in court trying to take it away from her. And I think it's disingenuous to suggest that in that instance, Mrs. Reed ought to have an attorney that will receive 25% of the benefits that she's already entitled to, or not have an attorney and lose those benefits. Attached as exhibits to my response, copies of the paper discovery that was served on Ms. Reed as a pro se defendant.
Well, Mr. Reagan, is there any dispute by Travelers that there's statutory authority to appoint an attorney for her?
Pardon me, Your Honor, I didn't understand that.
Is there a dispute by Travelers that there is statutory authority to appoint an attorney to represent Ms. Reed?
Your Honor, you understand I wasn't there when the record was made. I read the same record you are, but it's in the record that the representative, the attorney, told Judge Mayfield we're not contesting the appointment of an attorney, only the means and method of payment.
All right. So, what is the basis that you say the trial court had the discretion to order Travelers to pay interim fees on a monthly basis? Do you agree that there's none under the Constitution or statute?
The statute does not address that, Your Honor.
Is there any statute that
I do not know of any, Your Honor.
Sir?
I do not know of any statute.
So are we to inherent power?
Yes, sir. I believe so.
And what's the basis for the inherent power of the court?
Your Honor, if the doctrine of inherent power trial court is having a meaning, it must mean that the trial judge has the authority to fashion a remedy when none is provided by the law.
Now, counsel talked about the core functions of a court are what are involved in inherent powers.
I believe that's right, Your Honor, and this court over the years...
So your viewpoint that a core function is to fashion a remedy to meet a need whether there's authority for it or not?
Well, let me address it this way, Your Honor. I believe that the district court has a duty and obligation to the business of the court. And this court has adopted rules and amended rules quite frequently about docket control and management of cases and management of the attorneys. And here is a district judge who is faced with the proposition that this pro se litigant, 49-year-old lady with a high school education who's seriously ill, and she's required under the law, rulings of this court, to abide by the rules of procedure just like a licensed attorney. One slip and she's out the door. One slip and she's sanctioned. One slip and her case is dismissed.
But you don't contest the trial court could have met that need by assigning her an attorney. Would that attorney forced to wait for fees the same as an attorney she would have signed on herself would have been forced to?
Well, Your Honor, I'd have to say I would consider that to be the irony of all ironies. When the moving force behind adoption of the present workers' compensation statute was to get the claimant's attorneys out of the picture, and I think it would be very ironic to come back and say you're out of the picture fee-wise, but you're going to come back in on an appointed fee ratio or basis and wait 6 or 9 months to get your pay, meager as it may be.
If you're right about that purpose, and the compact has set out certain times when fees can be shifted,
right,
and it's not here, doesn't the inherent power of the court run up against a fairly comprehensive statutory scheme?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because as I read the statute, comp statute, it doesn't address nor doesn't appear that the legislature ever contemplated the situation that we have in this case, where a pro se defendant who prevails through the administrative procedure and has benefits awarded to her is then runs up against the biggest workers' compensation carrier in the state of Texas and files paper discussion, numerous requests for admissions, any one of which, please the court, failure to deny any one of them to throw her out on her ear. I don't think the legislature contemplated that, and I believe that the district court has the inherent power to fashion a remedy when there is none. It's not addressed in the comp statute. It's not addressed in the government code statute under which he had the authority to appoint.
Are travelers' fears that it may extend this money and never get it back? Are travelers' fears that it may extend this money and never get it back well-founded?
Well, in a pure academic standpoint, I think so, Your Honor. Just like Mrs. Reed's fear that she will be denied the benefits already awarded to her and she'll never get them, that's well-founded. Now, if there's any equity in our system, who can stand the loss better, travelers or Mrs. Reed? I understand.
But, I mean, what you're saying is if you take this money and then ultimately don't prevail beyond what, trying to think how to phrase this, is there any guarantee that you're willing to give to the opposing counsel so they won't have to worry that they might recover this money eventually through the normal statutory subrogation?
Is that a one-on-one question, Your Honor? Me,
I prefer to think it's nine-on-one.
Well, no, I mean, if you're asking me personally, I agreed with them at their request. I think everybody ought to have the day in court. And I said I won't pursue the collection of the money, $1,700. And I haven't reneged on that promise. I think they ought to have an opportunity to present their case here and have it heard. I think it's a unique...
Well, I'm really trying to narrow this to getting down to the irreparable injury question and trying to narrow it down, I guess, just to... And we see, you know, Lone Star really moots this point, but I was just thinking about payment as a possible point, trying to get that out of the way. The fear of money lost and just get down to the point of whether being obligated to finance your opponent's litigation would constitute an irreparable injury under Texas law.
I think it would require a management decision back before the suit or the appeal is filed, Your Honor, whether or not they really think they have an opportunity to have a legitimate case to set aside this award. Or is the litigation under these circumstances merely a club to beat Mrs. Reed and similarly situated claimants who have successfully appealed through the administrative procedure? They need to make that decision. If they think they really have a basis for it, then they ought to go ahead and file their suit.
Did Mrs. Reed file her claim before you were retained?
Excuse me?
Did Mrs. Reed file her cross-claim or however it's nominated before you came
in? Oh, long before, Your Honor. I think it can show up in the record, but I estimate it was a year and 15 months.
What kind of help did she have on that?
It appears that she probably got some beta lawsuit to help her, but I can't verify that. I don't know. It's not in the record, and I haven't asked her. Some of it is apparently some lawyer language, some of the pleading that she made, but it was crude at best. Something that I might have done the first year I practiced law. Some might say even similar to what I do now. But the fact is,
would you view the court's inherent power to authorize this same procedure anytime there's a pro se litigant?
No.
Why not?
Because in the context of this case, Your Honor, he's got to consider the facts and circumstances that presented to him at that time. Number one, pro se, who didn't institute the lawsuit, pro se defendant, and the nature of the litigation. Now, I wouldn't say that it should be done. I said the court had the power to do it.
So she brought the first appeal, and Travelers had merely cross-claimed?
No, the other way around, Your Honor.
No, I said if.
Oh.
If that, it might be a different result.
I think it'd be entirely different, Your Honor. It would be entirely different because then I believe the contingent fee arrangement, the provision of the comp statute, would be more applicable. Because as I understand that contingent fee statute, it says that the attorney can receive 25% of the amount recovered. Actually, it's an hourly rate, a reasonable fee, not to exceed 25% of it. But on the present part of this case, I don't see that Ms. Reed can be tagged with recovering anything because she already has it. She's defending what she already has.
Would the trial court, if it determined that the appeal by Travelers was frivolous, would they be able to sanction Travelers by ordering this payment?
Well, Your Honor, I believe so. I mean, if Rule 13 applies to insurance companies like it does to everybody else, I believe that they could be sanctioned for attorney fees, costs, or whatever the judge felt was reasonable under the circumstances.
That was not the basis for the court's order here.
No, ma'am. I don't find anything in the record that refers to the Rule 13 type sanctions. I sure don't. But by the same token, Mrs. Reed could be sanctioned. If she's there as a pro se defendant, she could be sanctioned for discovery delay or not showing up for a hearing or any number of things. I don't think Judge Mayfield would sanction either one of them unless it was just really a blatant violation of the rules, given nature being what it is, but the rules apply to each of them equally.
So Travelers could have had the best claim in the world, and you still think the trial judge did. In other words, whether the trial judge has this inherent authority in this situation does not depend on the merit of Travelers' position.
I don't think the inherent authority does, Your Honor, but there's...
So it could have been the comp board and the appeals could have just gone absolutely haywire.
That's right.
And Travelers could have a great claim that anybody looking at it on the merits would say they're going to prevail, and they still might have to advance these fees.
Your Honor, I think that the discussion is strayed from the point that I intended to make, maybe I didn't make it earlier on, is that this trial judge has the responsibility also to keep his docket moving and make his courtroom available to other litigants just other than this one. And perhaps some of you have had the experience of sitting as a trial judge with pro se litigants. And even the smartest ones can cause the trial judge untold misery.
Well, that's why I asked you. I understood that being your argument. That's why I asked you, didn't your rule apply to all pro se litigants? And that's true anytime you have a pro se litigant.
That's true.
Plaintiff or defendant or intervener.
That problem, that's true. Yeah. And the respondent, relator, I'm getting the title mixed up here, Travelers, in the record, their attorney pointed out to the trial judge, yes, we'd rather that she have an attorney. It's beneficial to us to have an attorney. They even recognize.
Well, but they can agree that she can have an attorney, but still not agree that they have to pay her.
That's true.
Her attorney.
That's true.
You would agree that's two different things.
That's true. That's true. But Judge Mayfield was faced with this real problem. A lady who apparently needed some legal help. A complex case, everybody admits, medical situation in this case. I've been practicing law 31 years, and most of it's been in the field of workers' compensation or personal injury, and I have never heard of this condition in 31 years. And I read the medical reports, and I don't understand it. It's very complex and complicated. And to suggest that a layperson could possibly present that in any fashion or form that would be understandable to a judge or a jury is not realistic.
Well, when travelers filed the appeal, did that set aside the commission's order for the $17,000 benefit recovery?
Your Honor, I'm going to have to plead ignorance on the effect of that. Under the old law, it did automatically vacate it. I do not believe that it does, but I can't be sure.
So, in other words, she's in court as a defendant with a viable $17,000 award that they have to set aside. That's her burden, their burden.
That's true.
But then she filed cross claims for what?
I think the pleading says she filed a cross claim for 401 weeks compensation.
Is that total and permanent?
Under the old law, that would be called total and permanent. That's the maximum benefits that are available under this law, too.
And that's a different amount than the $17,000.
Your Honor, I quite frankly don't know. I mean, I don't practice law. I don't practice under the New Comp Act. There's no place for me in the New Comp Act, so I just... What I know about it, I've learned accidentally or incidentally since this came up.
Mr. Ragland, I wanted to ask you, Mr. Young said the only sources of authority for this order would be either constitutional, statutory, or within the court's inherent power. And in Traveler's brief, they note that in the Ms. Reed's amended motion for an appointment of an attorney, the allegation was made that if there weren't some provision, that her position was that if there was not some way the trial court couldn't order the payment of your attorney's fees, that the Workers' Compensation Act would be unconstitutional insofar as it applies to Mrs. Reed. Is that still your position?
Well, that wasn't my position then. That was somebody else's, Ms. Reed's position, and I haven't addressed that there because I don't think it's a constitutional question is reached. It's solely an abuse of discretion under the pandemic's law, Your Honor, whether or not he abused discretion. I think it's even narrowed down now to abuse of discretion in the means and manner of ordering the payment.
No, I understand. But if we were to hold, as Mr. Young argues, that there is no inherent power in the trial court to order an attorney's fee here. Does Ms. Reed or do you on her behalf take the position that we have to decide a constitution?
Not in this proceeding, Your Honor, and I think that it would be a disservice to the bench and bar if it were done on a record developed by a pro se defendant. I really do. There's much more that needs to be investigated, presented to this court, and it ought to go up in the appellate procedure, let the trial court rule on it specifically, and make findings of fact and conclusion of the law, take it to the Court of Appeals and give them a shot at it, and then ultimately let this court in the regular appellate procedure. I think it would be a disservice to the bench and bar to make a constitutional determination on the record that was prepared by pro se.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Justice Baker, to answer a couple of your questions, the filing of Traveler's appeal did not vacate the Compensation Commission's order, and Traveler's continued, and to this day continues to pay Ms. Reed the temporary income benefits. And furthermore,
is that the same amount as the $17,000?
I don't know where they get the $17,000. I think that's an aggregate of all of the benefits that she would be entitled to under the current order. I'm still not sure how that's computed because the date of her maximum medical improvement has not yet been ascertained.
Mm-hmm.
Her counterclaim for 401 weeks benefits would have greatly exceeded $17,000. I'm not sure what the exact amount is. A couple of very brief points. A defense counsel, like a plaintiff's counsel, is worthy of his hire. And we believe under the Compensation Act, could be awarded a fee for defending benefits given by the commission or the appeals panel, just as he could be awarded a fee for obtaining benefits that those bodies had denied. And so we believe from each weekly check that Ms. Reed is now receiving, Mr. Reitman could obtain a court order entitling him to up to 25% of that weekly check. That would be a source of his fee on an ongoing basis. Secondly, with respect to the suggestion that Travelers filed this appeal as a leverage device rather than in pursuit of bona fide issues, I would point out to the court that there are both legal and factual issues that were involved in Travelers' appeal that made it well worthy of being filed. Question of whether aggravation of a pre-existing non-injury condition is a compensable event is a matter that is unsettled in the courts, and whether Ms. Reed, in the particular circumstances of her medical condition, qualifies under that standard is a factual issue that is worthy of considerable discussion.
But all of those reasons to make that appeal disappeared when you had to pay attorney's fees, so you didn't sue.
The balance of benefit versus risk changed when we had to pay attorney's fees, and we made the decision that if we were going to have to pay two sets of attorney's fees going forward, that it was not worth pursuing. That's correct. Justice Spector, yes, the court would have power to sanction Travelers like any other litigant for filing a frivolous lawsuit. And the court has not done that, and we don't believe that would be an appropriate circumstance here. The court also had other avenues available to it to protect Ms. Reed in the event that it viewed Travelers as overreaching her. First of all, the court has power over discovery and could regulate what discovery could or could not be submitted to Ms. Reed as a pro se litigant. It also had the power under the statute to appoint counsel for her, and we do not contest the appointment of counsel. The question then becomes, did the court have authority to order Travelers to pay that counsel under the inherent power of the courts? We say no, that if that was absolutely necessary for the court's functioning to appoint her an attorney, a matter which the El Paso court has said probably is not within the inherent power. But even if it is, the inherent power extends to compelling public funding of that which is necessary for the court system, not to conscripting private funding, particularly in light of the statutory policy of the Act, which is that attorney's fees for claimants are to be drawn from recoveries. Recoveries are to be net of attorney's fees rather than gross with attorney's fees added on. And the obvious purpose of that, as with the entire 1991 Act, was to reduce the transaction costs that were perceived as overburdening the workers' compensation system. If Travelers is ordered to pay Ms. Reed's attorney's fees, obviously that is a cost that ultimately must be passed on to policyholders in the form of premiums, and that just takes us back to the pre-1991 circumstances that led to the passage of the new Act.
Can you tell me very briefly how we can say that this is an abuse of discretion for which there's no remedy by appeal that's affected, and at the same time uphold our Canadian helicopter standard that there may be a special appearance that's wrongly ruled upon, but in the ordinary case you have to go through a trial and pursue that by appeal, or even a summary judgment that you're clearly entitled to but it's denied and you have to try the case and pursue that by appeal?
One's own litigation expenses are held in Walker versus Packer and numerous other cases not to constitute the kind of irreparable injury that the courts will take cognizance of. I'm not aware of any case that extends that to funding not only one's own litigation expenses, but one's opponent's litigation expenses as not constituting irreparable injury. That, I think, is the distinction. I think the abuse of discretion here is clear in the sense that there is no authority, no discretion really to be abused. And so then you focus on the inadequacy of the remedy of law, and what distinguishes this case from a summary judgment or a special appearance is that not only are you forced to go through the delay and expense of a trial, which is what every litigant is forced to go through, but you're forced to, on an interim basis, not at the end of the case when you lose, but on an interim basis, fund your opponent's litigation against you.
Of course, you're also required to pay her other payments
that
while
is,
the trial is...
That is correct.
And it may turn out that she's not entitled to any of those.
That's, we have to take that because that's the way it's given to us in the workers' compensation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.
All rise.